Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 5, Episode number 1 of Cinematica. Season 5 already, doesn't time fly. I'm Dan Slevin, and joining me here in the Cinematica studio is nobody, actually, because Kaylee is still in Sydney on her holidays, and Simon is very poorly and hasn't come to work today. So it's me here in the palatial luxury environs of the Cinematica studio, and on the line from Auckland we are joined by our very good friend Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times. G'day.
Hi there, Dan.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show, and here we are in each other's ears attempting to enlighten people about what they should be going to at the movies. How are you doing?
Very good, yes. Lately seen some better films than the crop that we are about to discuss, so things are looking brighter for the future at least.
They are, because it's a pretty ordinary week, I have to say, and maybe that's a good reason for Simon and Kaylee to sort of ducked out of this one,
they must
and
have known.
Leaving us holding the baby, as it were. In today's episode, Naomi Watts is the Queen of Hearts in Diana. Danny Trejo is back as Machete in Machete Kills. And Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington crack wise in the comedy thriller Two Guns. But first, before we get on to that, it's time to have a look at the mailbag. And this is normally Kaylee's job, as you know, but I will scroll back through the week of tweets to get your two-word reviews. We had some lovely feedback from TinRibs27 saying two space thumbs up for our discussion of Gravity. That's very kind of you to say so. We also got a little bit of feedback that one of our listeners hadn't seen the film and thought we were skating so close to the potential of spoilers that they had to stop listening. I'm hoping that all of you have caught up with Gravity, because at some point, no doubt, we will want to revisit that film and actually talk about what happens after the first 20 minutes. Some really good feedback from Reese Pye, also in England, our sort of about to be UK correspondent. And we have some two-word reviews from the Merca. Gravity, once again, breath-defying. That's a good one. And he's also seen, Reese Pye has seen Prisoners, which opens on Thursday. Of course, she's in a different country, and the nature of release dates means that sometimes she gets the things a little bit before us. Her two-word review of Prisoners, too long.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Do you have anything to contribute to that one? I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it would be premature. I think the length, though, just to say, what is it? It's over 2.5 hours, and it may put a whole lot of people off. But personally, I felt that it kept me gripped through that 2.5 hours. So, you know, that'll polarize people.
Yep, indeed. I haven't had a chance to see it yet. Opens, depending on when you're listening, either tomorrow, today, or yesterday. Fred Thompson on Twitter has given us a couple of films worth of two-word reviews. First of all, Machete Kills, Trailer Trash is his two-word review of that. This movie started off as a fake trailer and should have stayed that way. And he's also seen Two Guns, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on. Lethal Weapons.
Nice.
Yeah, so good work. Good work from all of you guys on the team. Time to look at what people have been going to see. And I don't think there's going to be too much doubt about what our number one film will be for last weekend. We've only got the report up to the 13th of October, so just the 4 days of the weekend. But looking at our top five, Grown Ups 2 down one place at number five. Planes still hanging in there. Of course, that was the very, very end of the school holiday, so Planes up one, in fact, from 5 to 4. The Smurfs 2 holding its own at 3. Turbo holding its own at number 2. And when I grew up in England, when they did the top 40, they used to call the songs that hadn't changed position non-movers. So all of our top three are non-movers, and the number one sound being Gravity, of course, and quite staggering amounts of money going through that. $1.8 million in the New Zealand box office for only 2 weeks in release. And in fact, I think you probably, because it's a short report, only 1.4 weeks. Turbo, incidentally, despite some mixed reviews, is also around that 1.8 million mark in New Zealand box office, and The Smurfs 2 has crept over 2 million in 4 weeks. So, you know, there's some good business being had there.
The thing with Gravity also, of course, is most people have been encouraged to see it in an IMAX or at very least sort of a large 3D format if they can, right? Which for a lot of people might mean gold class. So I bet that the ticket sales are automatically higher, aren't they, for that film than they will be for a lot of others, because people are taking it seriously and seeing it in the, you know, the biggest possible way.
It's time to start doing some reviewing, I would imagine. You ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Are you ready, Auckland?
Yes, we're ready. All of us.
It's still possible you might be queen one day.
I want to help people.
You're so good at giving love. The hard part is receiving love.
Doctor, this is Diana.
Well, perhaps I can show you around. There's a canteen on the ground floor, but it's not open late.
You could always pop around the corner for supper with me. I'm serious.
I don't know how to contact you.
Well, I'm like most people. I've got a mobile. Actually, I'm not like most people. I have four.
Cheers.
He doesn't treat me like a princess. It's almost as if he doesn't know who I am.
Maybe he doesn't. He might be very badly informed.
Were you a Diana file, Sarah?
Oh, there's so much I want to disclaim about this, but yeah, I was. And I remember that fateful night in 1997, which, of course, for us was the morning or daytime at least.
It was daytime.
I was truly gutted. I don't know if you remember, but even Auckland slumped into a depression for the best part of a week. And it really did feel as though, from my perspective, that the whole world had slipped into a parallel universe and things got really, really heavy. So, you know, I have to be honest with you. I did find the loss of she's Her Royal Highness, isn't she?
Because she never lost that.
She got this. She kept that. Good. Glad that she kept that.
And it's always so important that you're respectful, even from this distance.
I know, it is important. You know, the French still call her Lady Di, which is terribly cute. But move on, French people. But in any event, yeah, I was a bit of a fan, and I was sad when she died. And the biggest disappointment for me about this film was if I had been watching the same footage, but with the actual Diana, and it had therefore been vaguely documentary-like, it might have been a bit more fulfilling. And for some reason, and I tried, but for some reason I couldn't get over seeing Naomi Watts in that role. And listening to the trailer again, Dan, as well, you know how sometimes the trailer really doesn't do justice to the film?
Yep.
Unfortunately, this trailer
nails it.
Does all the injustice to this film that it deserves. Didn't you find?
Yes and no. Now, this is an example of a film whose reputation preceded it. It's already been castigated by critics in Diana's home country of England, Royal England, and because here we are 16 years or whatever it is on, and I don't think, you know, it's too soon. It's too soon for them. This is a country that sort of lost its collective mind during that week, and I don't think that it's ever really gotten over this. And so we heard was that this was a terrible idea, a terrible execution of a terrible idea, that it just shouldn't exist. You know, it's so disrespectful to the princes and bloody bloody blah, blah. Well, anyway, I don't really have a dog in this fight, because I didn't really care much for the royals while I was in England, and didn't really think much about them after I left, and looked on at that sort of circus of the funeral, memorial, the cortege, all of that fiasco with a sort of amused. It was like a telethon, really, for me. And to be honest, there were, I think, in my youthful sort of exuberance, I was too busy making jokes about Mother Teresa, and you know, so I didn't really care. which means that I could watch this film without it having any. I've got no stake in it, and therefore I can safely say, from a position of objectivity, yep, that this film is not the train wreck that everybody is making it out to be.
Really?
It's not very good. It's not very interesting, but it's not a fiasco. And I'll tell you what main reason why I think it's not a fiasco, and that is that Naveen Andrews, who plays the handsome surgeon lover, Hazmat Khan, exactly, who he's really good. And I found him to be quite watchable, and I thought he had some really good moments, and I thought that whenever he was on screen, the film sort of elevated itself a little bit to being... Like, we've seen some terrible
films. The thing is, though, dialogue was dreadful, Dan.
Yeah.
And I found myself watching, even though he was okay, and she did a really good job of trying to render everything that we know as that is the cliche of Diana. The things that they said to one another, some of which we heard in the trailer just now, I just found it excruciating, and I wasn't sure whether I felt cringed out because I was watching two sappy people fall in love, or whether it was because their courtship just seemed, I hate to say posh, I don't have an issue with posh, but it just seemed so awful, her kind of, oh well, I don't really know and I can't really make pasta, and they don't even make hamburgers, do they, and just all that grossness that I just didn't like that at all. So I couldn't even lose myself in the notion that, well, here are two people that I either don't know about or don't care about, but they're falling in love in a convincing way.
Yeah,
I couldn't even get in that, you know.
Well, the problems that I had with the film were, I think, firstly that she's not an uninteresting character, particularly the you know, her public persona and the effect of her on the worlds of fame and tabloids and a pre-sort of internet. I mean, can you imagine what her death would have been like if there'd been an internet during that week?
There was a modicum of internet in 97, but you're right, we weren't all on it.
We weren't. There was no Twitter. Was there?
No, there wasn't on Twitter, Dan, that's true.
Yeah, see, I don't have to refer that to the fact-checking department. But the thing is that her love life is probably the least interesting aspect of the life that she led, and here we are stuck for 2 hours dealing with the final 2 years of it, you know. So there's that, which is a bit of a problem. The other thing is that... they have these endless discussions about why they can't be together. Why can't we be together? We can't be together because of my job, etc., etc. And you just want to bash their heads together and say, get over yourselves, both of you.
Yes.
If you really gave a rat's...
If you really cared, you'd make it work.
Exactly.
And if you don't, move on and let her go off with Dodie.
Exactly.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. And the thing is that they have that conversation, what, half a dozen times?
Yeah.
In the film?
It's not even an interesting love affair. This is the thing.
No.
There isn't really anything holding them apart. She goes, she visits his family. They kind of like her, but not enough for her to marry him. But I didn't care enough about them being together.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with the fact that I knew that they weren't, because we know what happens factually, but I didn't care.
Way more interesting is actually the relationship between her and the royal family, which is sort of hinted at. And of course, that in an attempt to be sensitive to the lives of the real people who continue to operate within that sort of world, the filmmakers have sort of opted out of dealing with it. But I think that actually the separation from her children, the ostracism from the establishment, and the fact that she sort of went out of her way to try and build a second life for herself, I thought was kind of interesting, but not dealt with in any great doing.
I feel like Oliver Hirschbiegel, it's Oliver Hirschbiegel, isn't it? I feel as though he opted out of heaps to do with the film, and I feel as though
it's his fault necessarily, though. I suspect that the script, it all starts with the excuse me, with the script. And this is the third thing I wanted to say about this is far, far from the worst Oliver Hirschbiegel film that I've seen either. So, you know, he's made one really, really great film.
Which is Downfall.
Actually, I was thinking more about the experiment, Das Experiment, which...
Okay, did you not like Downfall?
You know what? I haven't seen Downfall.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so
you
I
can
had to
edit that bit out, Dan.
Yeah,
so don't
I think it's sometimes important for our listeners to realise that we are human beings too.
True.
But I have seen. It's very sad to report that I have seen The Invasion, which is the remake of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig, which is a truly, truly horrendous piece of work. So I figure this sort of falls somewhere in the middle. It's not a complete train wreck. I think his work is probably as workmanlike as you could possibly hope for. I think the script pulls its punches and focuses on all the wrong things. And
I agree.
You know, but you know, it's not a. I don't believe that it's a. You know, it's not a disaster. We're going to come to a disaster shortly. Actually,
it's not a travesty, but I don't think it does her or her memory any favors, because I don't think she came across as very likable or very intelligent or very compassionate. I think they mucked about with her going along and watching him perform surgery, yeah, and stopping at the graveside where someone's grieving and all that.
How manipulative she could be about that sort of stuff.
That's what it felt like. I felt like I was watching her be manipulative, as you say. Whereas when she was alive, I just sort of thought, oh, that's really nice, you know. So, yeah.
Well, let's see if we can sum this sucker up in two words.
My two-word review for Diana, Dan, would be royal pain.
Okay, my two are heartless.
Okay.
Mr. President, we have a situation.
He was trained to kill.
CIA, FBI, DEA all roll up in the war.
Then left for dead.
I know what they did to your family.
And now he's back.
Machete.
For his most dangerous mission yet.
You ready for this? Good for calls, texts, tweets.
Machete don't tweet.
Damn, you're good.
Right. I should have checked with you beforehand. I just want to confirm you have seen this.
Machete, I have indeed.
Machete Kills.
I have.
Have you seen the original Machete?
I did not see the original Machete.
So you're starting from a position of sort of innocence, shall we say.
Yes.
With regard
high
to
degree of innocence.
With regard to the franchise. So I'll take over the plot description role on this particular one. Machete is a film that started out as one of those mock trailers that appeared between the now legendary double feature, Grindhouse double feature that Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez put together, Death Proof and Planet Terror. And various directors were asked to produce sort of grindhouse trailers for mock trailers for films that didn't exist. And Machete was the most successful of all of them. And everybody went, man, we would love to see that film. The great Mexican character actor Danny Trejo plays Machete, a taciturn, mustachioed, tattooed thug who it would appear is impossible to kill, as Taika Waititi once said in a 48-hour film, he's undiable. And
nice.
So he's tough as old boots, and it also seems to be a bit of a hit with the ladies, because by the end of the first film he had managed to cop off with, what's her name, who dies at the beginning?
Jessica Alba.
Jessica Alba, that's right.
Spoiler alert, by the way, but you're right. She dies at the beginning, so I'm sure that listeners will forgive you.
Truly, if you're worried about that, that's the least of your problems, to be honest. But yes, so he is definitely a bit of a ladies' man, as well as being a force for good and all that is righteous and true. He is enlisted by the President of the United States, played by Charlie Sheen, billed as Carlos Estevez, which is his, in fact his real name. And he has to go south of the border to try and capture a terrorist who has a...
See, this is where it all gets a bit complicated, because there are kind of two baddies, aren't there?
There are two baddies. We can say that probably Mel Gibson's the big baddie pulling all of the strings. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler, because he arrives fairly early on in the piece. But anyway, there's a missile that has to be captured, and then there's one baddie, and then there's a... the trigger mechanism is attached to the heart of one of them. Anyway, it's all extremely complicated, very, very silly. It's at about this point in the film that I fell asleep. And, you know, there's nothing worse than falling asleep in a movie, waking up, and you don't know how long there is to go. And I kept thinking, oh, must be nearly finished. Oh, no, there's more. Oh, you know, and three times I thought, oh, this must be the final climax. And no, they all come back for another round. I'll confess to you, the first Machete film,
yeah,
almost, in fact, may well have snuck into my top 10 for the year in which it came out. This is how fond I was of the first Machete film. It was a really good, humorous, tight pastiche of B-movies. You know, that 48-hour, chuck it all together, see what sticks aesthetic. Machete Kills is the same joke spread way, way, way too thin. How do you feel about it? Without knowing the previous successes, I guess.
Yeah, well, I totally hear what you're saying, and I think that probably would be the case if I had seen the first one. And actually, even in this one, I didn't feel that I was seeing anything smashingly new. So I could understand. I don't know. I've always been a bit funny about Robert Rodriguez anyway. I totally, totally loved Desperado back in the day. But, you know, that whole business with Four Rooms and sort of the post-Tarantino era, I can't off the top of my head think of anything that he's done that I've really liked. And I feel like he's a bit stuck in the past. And I don't mean as far as the grindhouse past, but I feel as though even that's been done. You know what I mean? They revisited that genre and everybody got really excited about it. And I sort of feel as though perhaps Machete was a one-trick pony and he shouldn't have gone back for more. But that said, I didn't fall asleep in it and I thought it was perfectly serviceable. And I think that for me, it rode quite a lot on some of the intrigue with the chameleon character. I thought was very interesting, you know, going from, I don't know if this is too much of a spoiler or not really, but, you know, going from one famous face to the next. It's always interesting to see what Lady Gaga's going to do, although she wasn't massively impressive. But even, you know, I've been likening this to, I think I said something like Tarantino was the one who would restore the careers of those who had been the great and the good, and Rodriguez is the one who perhaps the disgraced go to in order to be rehabilitated. And that's why we've got Mel Gibson and Jesse James and Carlos Estevez and people like that. So, you know, there are kind of like moments of amusement to be had in that regard, but it doesn't really a film maketh, does it?
No, it doesn't. And he's so proud of his sort of handmade aesthetic and the fact that everything's shot down in Austin and it's all super cheap. And let's be honest, that missile almost deliberately looked like a toilet roll that had been painted in sort of middle school art class.
Yes.
And you know, I think he's always been really proud of the fact that you just make them fast. He shoots everything himself. He writes all his own music. You know, and he does all the editing. I think he even cooks the lunches, you know.
Right.
So
yeah.
I have to say that I'm kind of fond of his kid stuff. I think that aesthetic, I think, works really well when you're
Spy Kids and whatnot.
Yeah. When you're pitching at sort of 9, 10, 11 year olds, I think that sort of pace and that throwing gags and some work and some don't, I think that's, you know, it's pretty good. You know, they're not going to remember it. It's going to be, you know, they're going to enjoy themselves, and they see kids their age on screen. I think all of that stuff is great. Like I say, the first Machete, I got a really big kick out of. I thought it also, the first Machete also had a really powerful underlying message about immigration and the role of the Latino community and the Mexican community in America. And I think it actually it dug quite a few it scored a few points very, very well in that film. And this one I think actually relies way too much on stereotypes actually, and sort of sells out its community to a degree. So yeah, that was a big disappointment to me. What do you think?
From a feminine or a feminist perspective,
it's pretty hateful, isn't it, towards women?
Well, I don't feel that this was actually. Oh. I think that you've always got a double-edged sword if you are. I think that there are so many examples recently of directors perhaps purporting to have strong characters on screen. I'm thinking immediately of Spring Breakers and then dressing them all in bikinis the whole time, including when they go to jail, including just the whole time, which I had a real problem with. And you could possibly argue that here, but I did think that Amber Heard, for example, her character, despite being completely dressed up to the nines and an absolute, never mind male fantasy, anybody's fantasy really, because she looked $1 million, but she was still a tough character, and at least he had...
She's a pretty dreadful actor, though.
She was fine in this for the role that she was doing. Right. I mean, it wasn't Paranoia. Did you see her in Paranoia?
Yeah,
that was pretty average. No, I mean, I don't know. I thought that she kind of had some sort of guts in this. And even though Sofia Vergara is always, you know, always rolled out to just be the stunning, beautiful woman that she is, and admittedly she's playing the madam of a whorehouse and whatnot, even she, at least, I mean... At least there were women in the film, Dan, and at least it wasn't pain and gain, you know?
We don't agree on pain and gain either, do we?
No one agrees with me on pain and gain. I don't even think Michael Bay agrees with me on pain and gain. But nonetheless, I thought that was deplorable. Whereas at least here, there is some lip service being paid to the fact that these women have characters that they can actually get their teeth into, even if they have to look like, you know, Jessica Rabbit, sexual fantasy.
True. I was just a little bit put off by how easily. I mean, I suppose everybody's shot pretty easily. Everybody dies. You know, there seems to be a wanton disregard for human life generally, but the women in particular, it seemed were disposed of with a certain amount of efficiency, shall we say. So I was a bit sort of taken aback by that, but perhaps that's just me being oversensitive. Now Mel Gibson, back from the brink, he used to be the most charismatic star on screen. He used to have a twinkle in his eye, a little bit of danger about him. You know, he wasn't the biggest star of his generation by accident, and you know, he's paid his dues, supposedly. He's been sort of tempted back. What did you make of him in this?
I felt nothing for him whatsoever. And this has nothing to do with any kind of moral judgment I might have about his behavior. I don't really care about any of that particularly. I just found him really dull and kind of flat. And it's interesting you say twinkle in eye. I didn't get a twinkle in his eye at all. If anything, he just looked a bit rough. And I thought he was really boring. But my companion at this film thought that actually he did a terrific job.
Oh, really?
So who knows? You know, go figure.
Yeah, go figure indeed.
And that person who loved Machete actually thought this was superior to Machete. So, yeah. So.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah,
okay.
But I wasn't impressed with Mel. What did you think?
I thought that he looked like he was pulling out all of his box of tricks without any real... heart to it, or without any real sort of love for what he was doing anymore. I thought that he looked like somebody who was sort of flailing around, to be honest. And he's not working with the greatest script in the world, and he's working with basically cardboard Doctor Who sets. So, you know, this must, for all of his sort of gameness for wanting to get involved, you know, it's sort of beneath him in terms of where his star power could have gone. But he's also not looking all that flash, is he?
No, he's not.
I just thought he looked like somebody who was tired and not really that into it, and just...
He looks like someone who was a megastar 20 years ago, which is exactly what he was.
And yet Charlie Sheen... sort of knows the limitations of his character, knows the limitations of his persona, and sort of stays sort of resolutely sort of in the middle there, and you know,
I thought Charlie was terrific in this, and I get this. This is really interesting that you say this, because I hadn't thought about it till now, but it's almost like Charlie Sheen has never really expressed any sort of remorse, in inverted commas, and I say that because, again, I'm not making a judgment on what he should or shouldn't be doing about his private life. But Charlie Sheen has been taking the piss thereafter and continues to in this film. He's so obviously with that whole, you know, smoking a joint or getting high or whatever it is. I can't remember exactly.
My favorite joke in the film was the Southwest Wing. of the White House. That was and it was downhill from then on, unfortunately. Do you have two words for machete kills?
Slash and burn.
Okay, my two words for machete kills: machete snores.
Okay.
And so I should just point out for listeners who are just joining us, if you've just tuned in and you're wondering where Kaylee is and where Simon is, I think this is the first show in 2 years where we haven't had one or other or all of them here. Kaylee's on holiday in Sydney. I've seen some photographs that she has posted to her Facebook page, and she does look like she's having a bloody brilliant time, and the weather is fantastic, unlike the weather here in New Zealand has been for the last week, so she's done very well to miss out on that. Simon, unfortunately, is very poorly and isn't at work today, so we send best wishes to him and a very heartfelt get well soon. And hopefully he'll be back next week to and get a chance to see some films in the meantime. Time for some news. And in the headlines, New Zealander Eleanor Catton this morning won the prestigious Man Booker Prize in London for her novel The Luminaries. We mentioned this on the show because presumably at some point in the future it will be a film. Have you read The Luminaries?
I haven't. I've bought a copy and I have a greedy finger ready to go to it. But no, I've had bigger fish to fry till now, but definitely I'm keen.
It's particularly well suited to put your monitor on so that it's up at eye level.
So, but what are you dissing the book? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying it's very big.
Like you could
it is. It's big.
Doorstop analogy. It's, we might have saved several minutes.
Yeah, I know. I could have done the doorstop analogy, but then it's the same. It's the same joke everybody else is doing. I have to plough my own furrow. More news. The Alamo Drafthouse campaign to prevent texting in movie theatres claimed its first scalp earlier this week when Madonna was banned from all cinemas in the chain after she was seen using her BlackBerry throughout the New York Film Festival screening of 12 Years a Slave. Apparently, lots of people actually hissed at her and asked her to put it away, and she turned around and said, it's business.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. So no tickets whatsoever, even if she pays, to any of the Alamo Drafthouse chain. And I would imagine, she's becoming the poster child for all that is wrong with people at the movies nowadays.
But just you wait, Dan, until they extrapolate from that the fact that it was during 12 Years a Slave as well. So she's clearly racist and insensitive as well.
Exactly. I think, and possibly only there to have her photo taken on the red carpet. Not that interested in films at all, in fact. Regular listeners will know that we don't usually comment on casting news for films that haven't been made yet, except, of course, for 50 Shades of Grey, which we're following very, very closely. Therefore, the news that Pacific Rim's Charlie Hunnam has pulled out of the spicy romp is of great interest to all of us here in the Cinematica family, and which means we can start speculating, of course, on who's going to take his place. I'm presuming that you've been reading 50 Shades of Grey in lieu of The Luminaries?
No, and I'm not just saying that because I'm trying to preserve whatever credibility I might have. No, I genuinely haven't read it, and I absolutely don't care, except that I just don't like Charlie Hunnam, whatever his name is. I just don't like him.
Oh, is he a Hummin or a Hunnam? It's like Hanmer, isn't it?
Hanmer. I just don't like him, Dan, and I will have to watch the film, and I wouldn't want to watch him in it. So I'm just thrilled that he's not in it, and I don't really care. They could go for almost anybody else.
Gerard Butler. I'd be happier. That would be my worst nightmare.
Who?
Gerard Butler.
Oh God! Well, it can't be someone that old, can it?
Can it? I don't know. I haven't read the book. I mean, I'm presuming that isn't it like 9.5 weeks only updated?
That ages me.
Yes,
it does. I think it is, except that my feeling about Charlie Hunnam is that he's not very old, so I would have thought Gerard Butler was a different generation to him.
True. Yep. Okay, well, we shall see.
Michael Shannon. Wouldn't that be good casting?
See, there we go. I would go to that. Have you seen the brilliant Michael Shannon reads the letter from a sorority sister to her, or sorority head to her sisters? on. It's very, very funny. Just do a search on Michael Shannon sorority on the Google machine.
Is it scary?
It's very scary and very, very funny.
That is awesome.
So that is the news. Except just as we were going to air today, we heard a rumour that Wellington was going to lose another cinema, and it's looking really likely that Island Bay is going to lose the Empire Cinema as of today.
Why? Because of what?
Because they can't pay their bills at the moment is apparently the reason. And so with the Ascot closing not very long ago, that's seven screens that the Wellington region will have lost in just the last 3 months or so.
That's crazy.
It is. It's we've always sort of felt that Wellington was a little bit overscreened anyway, but to drop so many is quite something. And I think it just goes to show that Wellington is still suffering a lot more from this recession and the public service spending downturn than the Wellywood spending downturn as well. You know, as I was saying to somebody a little bit earlier on today, you know, those heady days where Auntie Helen, you know, added whole entire new wings to the public service, and we had Sir Peter throwing money around like water doing Lord of the Rings. There was 10 really, really good years down here in Wellington, and those appear to be gone forever. So it's very sad when movie theatres close, but I suspect also a big factor is the cost of going digital. And you know, those every time you convert a screen from 35 millimeter to digital, it costs you, you know, around about $200,000. So, you know, and you have to pay it one way or another, either through the VPF or just in cash. Another factor for cinemas here, and I imagine that this will be the case in other parts of the country as well, is the increased insurance costs post the earthquakes in the South Island and here in Wellington. So, I know a lot of cinemas are finding that their insurance bills are absolutely going through the roof, which, you know, is pushing some marginal businesses right to the edge. And if you don't have a chain to back you up, or if maybe an international or Australian parent, it can be really, really tough for
people.
Isn't
that interesting then, that it's running costs? It's operational costs, isn't it, that's doing them in? It's not just people aren't going to the movies anymore, or
Wellingtonians aren't going to the pictures. Exactly. Costs, it's one-off cost or major external forces that businesses, small businesses can't really cope with. I'll tell you what, it's not going to just affect the cinema business. There are lots of small businesses that are operating in buildings that need earthquake strengthening, or perhaps I mean, everybody's insurance is going up, we all know that. So, you know, I just think it's touch and go for a lot of people these days, and which means we should go and do our best to support the ones that are still standing.
Yes.
So time for our final film of the day, and this is one I hope we can be a little bit more enthusiastic about.
What is that? Is that a badge in your hand?
DEA.
Petty Officer Michael Stigman.
You know Bobby Beans was DEA?
Man, your boy Stig's a piece of work.
Did you know he was Special Forces? The bank was a setup. We gotta figure out whose money that was.
Well, like we're working together?
No, not like we're working.
Yeah!
No, like we're working in the same vicinity.
Together.
In the same area code.
Together.
It's funny, wasn't it, that we were talking about Mel Gibson a little bit earlier on, and of course his heyday were the buddy thrillers of Lethal Weapon, exactly. And this is a real throwback to that period, and you know, for a lot of people, that's going to be music to their ears, isn't it? Do you want to see if you can,
Gordon Bennett? Do I have to tell the plot? That's going to be tricky, isn't it?
Well,
okay.
I'd rather you than me, really.
I don't really think the plot's that relevant, but I'm going to have a bash at this, and you feel free to jump in and
sure,
and put me right. So you've got Denzel Washington, you've got Mark Wahlberg, and at first we don't really know whether they are crooks or not, but we watch them setting up a crime, or what we assume to be a crime. Then there's a tricky kind of flashback Or is it a flash forward? No, it was a flashback. A little bit of slow motion, something exploding. I remember that. And then at some stage we discover that one of them is a DEA agent. That's Drug Enforcement Agency, I believe.
I think so, yes.
And then we discover that the other one is, what is he?
He's a Navy, he's sort of Navy intelligence, which I didn't even know that there was such a thing. He's like, so you've got...
Have you not seen A Few Good Men? That's all about naval intelligence, isn't it?
No, oh, that's no. about the naval justice.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Sorry. As you were.
So it's this weird thing is that they're both partners. They're both undercover, but neither of them know that the other one is undercover until this robbery goes bad. The idea behind the robbery being that they would use the robbery as cover to be able to get evidence against another of those sort of fabled cartel drug dealers.
And also the whole notion of them being made partners as well, Dan, I think that's a bit odd as well, isn't it? Because isn't each of them sent in by their organization on the assumption that the other guy is an actual crook?
That's right, except that there are levels of corruption, as we discover as the film sort of unravels. And the further our two heroes dig into how it was that they were set up together in the first place, they start to realise, you know, it's like, how high does this go? To the top, it goes to the very top. And, you know, every step they take, they realise they're being basically double-crossed or sort of bamboozled by one side or another. And it's, you know, part of the fun, I think, of this film is seeing how they cope with each individual sort of double-cross, each twist and turn. The chief pleasure to be had in the film isn't the action, although there's plenty of it.
No, it isn't.
It's not particularly exciting or well shot. This is really all about the
relationship, right?
Exactly.
It's the chemistry.
It is between Denzel Washington and Mark Wahlberg, and you know the extent to which you enjoy this film will entirely depend on your tolerance for either or both of those together. How do you feel about it? You after Pain and Gain comments from earlier on in the show, I suspect Wahlberg's not the top of your Christmas card list.
Do you know what I was saying to someone yesterday? Mark Wahlberg is eternally forgivable by me. I don't know what it is. He's not even my type, in inverted commas, but I would say he can do no wrong. And in actual fact, what I mean is he can do heaps wrong and I will always invite him back. But no, I wasn't impressed with Two Guns. I've got to be honest with you, Dan. I felt as though it was – I couldn't stop thinking about Tony Scott and how all of a sudden, you know, RIP and all that, I miss him all the more because he would have been the guy to do this because obviously he did Denzel plus one, didn't he, all the time. But I liked Mark and Denzel as a pair. I did think they had lovely chemistry, and I think Mark was particularly good at playing that slight doofus, as we hear in the trailer just before the whole, oh, you mean we're working together? Well, we're in the same vicinity. We're together.
Yeah, exactly, you know, exactly. I'm pretty sure that there's no major Hollywood star alive that plays Dim quite as well as Wahlberg does, which I'm not quite sure what that says about him, to be honest.
I think it says he's incredibly smart.
Yeah.
So I do think that was really nice. But, I mean, the story bored me. I mean, actually confused me a little bit as well, but not confused me enough to keep me interested, personally, just saying. I think it got all a bit convoluted for the heck of it. And I also thought that some of the jokes were a little bit overplayed. Or maybe it was the fact that they shot those five chickens that were buried in the ground right at the beginning. I don't know, really, but it didn't massively work for me. And another thing that I didn't like about it is Paula Patton, who I liked enormously in Deja Vu, again with Denzel Washington, which was a Tony Scott film. Mm. I'm like...
And Mission Impossible, the last Mission Impossible film.
Yes, that's right, she was. And I think she's terrific. I think she was great in both of those. And all of a sudden she's here and she's, you know, topless.
Eye candy, yeah.
You know, and it's just all a bit lame through the whole thing. But then I found out she's married to that Robin Thicke who does that Blurred Lines song. So I've completely gone off her now anyway, so who cares?
Yeah.
But, the levels of intrigue. Now, I don't know, I found this disappointing. However, I took my mum along as my plus one, and my mother loves all Tony Scott's films and she loves anything with Denzel Washington, and she actually found it very enjoyable. So there you go.
Well, I didn't not enjoy it. I thought that this is a film that is, I think, destined to have a kind of a reasonable life in home video. I think that, you know, people who are surfing around the video store and they see exactly as it's meant to be, you see Denzel Washington and Mark Wahlberg on the cover, and you think, boom, that'll do exactly what it says on the tin. I agree that what it does is, it is for people of a certain age like myself, it reminds me of the golden age of great buddy action comedies without ever approaching the heights of them. And you know, it's you've got to be super careful when you start saying, like, you know, in my day.
Yes.
Because actually, you know,
particularly when you're only like 25, Dan, like you are.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. But you know, everybody has their day, and everybody has the stuff that they grew up with and that they feel nostalgic about and that they like the best. You know, and of course, you can't make young people go back to those old films. You know, you could sit them down, you could force them to watch Lethal Weapon, and they'll be bored out of their trees, because actually they are kind of old fashioned now. Yeah, exactly. So every generation needs their own, is what I'm saying. And I just felt like this is I've seen all of the people involved in this be better, do better. Particularly the director, Baltasar Kormákur, or whatever his name is, the Icelandic director, who, whenever he's working in Hollywood, is basically just Mark Wahlberg's hack.
Yeah.
But when he's working in Iceland on his own stuff, is really, really interesting and cool, and does, you know, like, I think he's just got some really great chops about him, you know. So it's always a disappointment when he sort of goes back to Hollywood and takes the paycheck. And, you know, I just felt like, you know, it just doesn't quite hit. I can imagine if I was a studio executive, you'd get the script, would come across your desk, and you go, boom, I know exactly. You give it to Tony Scott, and you get Denzel, and you get somebody to play against Denzel, and you'll go away for 3 months, and you get something that's going to make money. And this, I think, will probably make money for all concerned, but it's pretty forgettable ultimately. It passed a couple of fairly amusing hours out of the wind and the rain in a Wellington spring, and, you know, unfortunately I can't say much more about it than that.
You make an interesting point, though, when you hark back to our day and the Lethal Weapons and that sort of thing. And for me, it was Beverly Hills Cop, mm-hmm. right? Similar kind of buddy format, racially and in all aspects, right? Mm. And I think that we were younger when we watched those, and we didn't really maybe interrogate them the way that we would interrogate these films. And so you're right, the youth of today, or the 20-year-olds of today, or whomever, will go watch this. And as you say, they'll pass a very happy couple of hours, and it's sufficiently modern that, you know, they'll enjoy it and all that. And
it's sweary, which they all seem to like these days.
The what?
It's sweary, isn't it, as well, which they all seem to like these days. It sort of makes people feel more grown up than they are.
Well, that's right. One shout out I would give to this film is James Marsden. Actually, he played the naval officer, and he wasn't in it very much, but he had his square jaw and his buzz cut, and I actually thought that it was nice to see him doing something different from, you know, the old Hairspray and 27 Dresses. And
I think that's a very good point that you make there. For a long period of time, I actually got him and James Franco mixed up, and of course Franco went off and reinvented himself as whatever it is that he is.
Exactly.
But at least you now know, you know, James Franco is something. You know, he isn't this sort of clean cut, chiseled jawed. What's the male version of an ingenue? Anyway. And so Marsden's sort of got that whole thing wide open for him, and he could play it safe. He could, you know, and I thought, it was you know, nice work. But we're really clutching at straws now, aren't we? To be honest, in terms of trying to find something to get enthusiastic about. What can you sum this up in two words? Do you think?
Déjà vu.
wise. Crackin' double crossin', that's basically all.
Are they hyphenated? Because I thought it was only two words, but if you're going for wisecracking as one word, I'll let you have that.
Well, wisecrack is one word.
Okay.
Yeah, double cross is one word hyphenated. I think we're allowed that. And we've decided last week to get Simon out of a jam that you can use and of.
So, oh, okay, I didn't know that. That's you can certainly use an slash and burn then.
Yeah, you can use ampersands.
Right.
And for future reference. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week, Prisoners, which we have mentioned ever so briefly. It's a gritty Oscar contender starring Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal. Justin Timberlake is also back on the big screen with his online poker thriller Runner Runner, and no doubt we'll have some more as well. Here's just a question before we go. Did you see the Metallica film?
I didn't. And I was not invited to the screening of that because somebody, the great and the good, made the assumption that that was not my kind of film. And it could possibly be because I gave the One Direction documentary 5 stars. But I should just like to say here and now, I'm a massive Metallica fan and I would have loved it.
Well,
did you go?
I did go, and it was the funniest film I saw all weekend. And
intentionally or
no, right, no, I suspect not. I suspect considerably funnier than its makers intended, and very, very strange film. The funniest moment of the entire weekend's movie going, in fact, was at the very end of the closing credits when the lights went up and a Metallica fan sitting in front of me went, "Oh, now I get it," and the whole place just fell apart laughing because you just, like, it's nonsense. It's written by these all four of the band plus the director, and you just get the impression that they've all just thrown ideas in and nobody's made any attempt for it to make sense. It's a concert movie with a kind of backstory. Threaded through the scenes, and that story makes no sense. It's a sort of,
but is the concert footage amazing?
No.
Oh, really? Do they do whole songs?
Yeah, they do whole songs. But now, you see, you're a Metallica fan, right? And I have to say that for me, it all sounds the same. Every single song starts with, and then there's a little on the guitars, and then the singer goes, and every single song,
James, thank you, but yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and like it is, it's just, and you know, and it's, you know, they went through that much publicized psychological.
That's a great film.
Yeah, it is. It is a great film. But you look at the whole show is in the round, right? So yes, they're in an arena and they're in the round, and it looks like their psychologist has given the advice that he's given them to, in order to maintain their career and not kill each other, is to all basically just piss off to all four corners of the stage and not talk to each other. So there's no interaction between any of them to speak of. They just all sort of head off. They've all been given a corner of the arena to try and entertain. There's no banter between songs, and those songs all sound the same, and the songs are also all the same teenage nihilistic death anthems that just don't, like, these people are, they're 50 years old and they live a great life. What it's just something, you know,
25 years ago it had more resonance probably.
Yeah, if you never left your bedroom, yes, yeah, probably. But anyway, so there we go. Seriously, I'm so glad I saw it, because now I sort of get why I never really liked them, and now I know. So, well, you know,
from everything I've heard, Dan, all I can say is I highly recommend that you go to One Direction, This Is Us.
I've seen that. I saw One Direction. If you'd heard the show, we talked about it in our summer holiday, not summer, school holiday special just a
I
couple of weeks
that.
Ago. Yes. I didn't mind the One Direction film. I just felt it lacked a little bit of drama. Like all of these films, they need something to be, you know, the Justin Bieber film, he had the nodules on his vocal cords, and the Iron Maiden one, you know, the golf ball, he gets hit by the golf, he may not be able to drum that night. And the One Direction one, there's nothing happens.
No.
So, yeah.
Well, actually, Zayn buys his mum a house and everybody cries, and I thought that was quite moving.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, go back to a couple of episodes ago, and you know, you'll have to fast forward through all the turbo stuff. But we do get to it in the end. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software, so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. Please leave us feedback at the iTunes store, those ratings, those reviews. Keep us number one in New Zealand movie podcast-dom. You can contact us with your two-word reviews via Twitter at Cinematica Cast, Facebook. We Are Cinematica podcast on Facebook. We're on Letterboxd. We Are Cinematica there. At our website, cinematica.co.nz. Look, there's lots of ways you can get in touch with us. You can tell us to shut up and be faster if you want. This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. This is actually the music that I really should have played last week. And in the absence of any other likely contenders for the show this week, we're going to this one instead. This is, of course, the hardest working man in show business, Mr. Please, 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 the godfather of soul, James Brown, and his take on Gravity. Until next week, that's all from me. Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times, thank you very much for being on the show.
Always a pleasure, Dan, never a chore.
And Simon and Simon and Kaylee will be back next week, I'm sure. Thanks very much, everybody, for listening. Cheerio.